Okay, we're live now. All right, this is Brock Allen with Tom Grace here in our underground location in the Boston, Massachusetts area. And we're here to talk about growth hacking to $100 million in 3 years. And we're going to be talking about modeling after another company that has achieved this goal. And this is all part of a bigger, broader goal of trying to do growth hacking to create a unicorn company. So in this inaugural recording, we want to talk about some basic concepts and some basic ideas, things that we've been discussing and thinking about for a few years now. Tom and I actually go way back in terms of working together back to, I think, 1995, something like that. And our paths have diverged at various points, but now we're coming back together to try and work on this growth hacking to 100 million project. So with that having been said, I want to kick this off and just talk about, what the goals are, what the overview is, who our target market is, how will this help people, how will we make money, how will we actually get paid, what the general concepts of an initial launch would be, what some critical success factors will be, what some initial milestones or income goals are, and then talking about some various obstacles and challenges that we can foresee at this point. So having said all of that, as I mentioned at the beginning, the goal here is really to think about how we can model after a company or various companies that have achieved rapid growth in a very short period of time. And part of my initial idea for this was thinking about companies that are unicorns, which is to say companies that have valuations of at least $1 billion or more, that have achieved that status in a very short period of time. And of course, they made it to becoming a unicorn by hitting certain milestones along the way, one of which is $100 million in revenue. And that's really what we're talking about. So having said all of that, Tom, why don't you chime in with some ideas you have about all of this stuff?
Growth hacking is kind of interesting concept, right? Right from the 50,000 foot level. One of the characteristics of growth hacking is the pure focus on growth, right? What does that really mean? So putting everything else aside, it forces you to think about how we really grow. And a lot of the growth hacking culture will say is almost anti-advertising, right? Rather than go and pay an advertiser to do stuff, we're going to figure out a way to do it ourselves using, regular email lists, social media, or
And incentivized viral
marketing,
referral
right?
marketing, yes.
So in there, you think about, hey, this is the base of the world that we live in for growth hacking is using these established tools. We're not going to pay for advertising in any kind of form. That's a tough one to swallow if your focus is really growth. Google keywords, as long as you can figure out how to optimize that can be done. But going back to that pure focus on growth, and in this case, it's almost a 24/7 job, right? To say, hey, we're going to push this growth hacking. And in there's a whole bunch of concepts, about using CRMs, using
And explain CRMs just quickly.
Contact relationship management.
Sure.
Right? So a long time ago, this was a type of system that kind of came to be in order to help companies work, partner companies to work closer together. Kind of, it was the idea of creating a relationship. Certainly the sales aspect of this kind of picked up and saying, hey, a CRM would lead us to, capture better leads, see better information about our current customers, about how they buy, when they buy, spending habits. So the sales aspect really kind of took over CRM directionally. And I think, in the last couple of years, it's a little bit more than just sales that's taken that on. It's that perspective of having those touches out to potential customers. And in this case, where growth hacking kind of plays, it's really having your email lists, right? And we're having them in a structured way, and we're being able to reuse them. And the key piece here is to automate, right?
Absolutely.
So in this
And
case,
really the underlying concept there is to, or overarching concept is to have a structure in place, something that will enable you to measure what your progress
that's
and
correct.
to make adjustments as you proceed, and to think about how you can amplify the things that are really working and stop wasting time and resources on things that aren't working.
That's correct. And right. and in that kind of automation, right, that piece there is to say, hey, I've sent out, 1,000 emails. I've had from those emails 100 people click through to a page, right?
Right.
And then on that page, you can see how well they click through on that one. You can do your A/B testing on that page to see, what's really, or understand, what it's going to take from driving somebody from page one to page two.
Right. And excuse me, I just want to interject something too. There's this longstanding principle or saying or axiom in the advertising world, which is that 50% of all advertising is a total waste of money, but nobody knows which 50% it is. And, in the digital age that we're all in now, that should be a thing of the past. But when you really think about it, how many people actually do measure their results? How many people do measure all of this stuff? It's really, when I say people, how many companies do it? It's very, very few. And I'm going to say it's less than 20% that do, and I bet it's less than 5% that really do. And, I'm really just applying a rough Pareto principle, 80-20 yeah. kind of rule to that. But I'm quite sure that those things are true. It's hard to measure all this stuff.
Well, it is if you're not thinking about it when you build it.
Right.
We're going to pause here until we're talking before.
Hey. Sorry.
No, no problem.
We're using your space, so appreciate it.
I just wanted to hear this.
Hey, good to see you. That's the CFO.
We could have made him a guest speaker.
We could have. Yeah, that's funny.
So in there, where we say companies don't, but if they thought about it, and probably more and more companies will, and I'll kind of divide those. So people that don't have money tend to think about how to do these things on the cheap, which leads us to the whole underlying growth characteristics of growth hacking companies versus larger companies. And larger companies do spend money on the analytics behind all these things, but would they follow the same approach that somebody that had no money?
Right, right, exactly. Right. And we're talking about doing this thing with no venture capital,
right,
with no loans, basically.
Well, no product, right? So,
well, we're going to create a product.
That's
though,
right. In there, if companies have an established product, they have analytics around how well those products are doing in the market,
right,
which tends to say not how, necessarily how they could do better or how they're going to do worse, or to tag it a different strategy approach.
Yeah.
And, in our past life, we saw this with book publishers and selling. They had an established list of distributors and sellers that they would target.
Yeah.
And, as Amazon came along, they didn't look at Amazon being only one
yeah.
online retailer as a new channel.
Yeah.
And they kind of ignored it until they got their lunches ate, right?
Yeah.
So in that case, they started to push for more and more percentage of the profit. They pushed distributors away by saying, hey, we can kind of warehouse your inventory for you and distribute it via our vehicle versus, the established vehicles that were in the market at that time.
Well, since you brought up our past lives, working together yeah. in the book publishing world, Amazon is obviously a phenomenal, 20 million pound gorilla, whatever you want to call it,
yeah.
that's, just dominating the world right now and is an example of a phenomenal growth hacking success. And I would say that growth hacking success started with the concept. It started from from Jeff Bezos bootstrapping his own company. And I remember when we were actually at Book Expo back in 1997, 1998, 1999, and we were first hearing about this company, Amazon, and it just seemed crazy. He was losing money on every sale, and there was no way he was going to make it to profitability and all this kind of stuff. And then now you look at where he is, and
yeah.
this is, it's fascinating. Now, we don't have obviously he raised a lot of capital. He came from a equities background, Wall Street background, I believe, and so he had the ability to tap into capital, but we don't want to do that. We want to figure out how to make this thing profitable really from the get-go.
Right.
And that really takes us back to the original company we're going to model here, where that company, it's worth noting that company did have some momentum already. I believe I had read that at one point they were at a $20 million level, and that was, you know, probably 3-5 years before they started this new venture that did make it to $100 million in 3 years. And so they had some earlier successes. They had a lot of momentum. They had a mailing list to tap into. They had an army of affiliates that would promote and sell their products for them. They had a lot of momentum that we don't have at this point,
right.
But we have the ability to look at what they did, analyze what they did, and to model it and figure out our own version of this, albeit looking at a completely different vertical. When I look at what they did to reach 100 million, I really feel like they were focusing on a broad vertical of internet marketers, online marketers, you know, little one-man shops, if you will, like kind of like a cottage industry,
yeah,
of individual entrepreneurs that are trying to make extra money on the side.
Right.
And what we're really talking about with our initiative here is to look at some very specific verticals, technology verticals, that are rapidly emerging, rapidly growing, and to figure out how we can tap into those to create a product that will have a great deal of appeal and adoption and traction, and to accelerate the adoption and traction as quickly as we can. So that leads to the concept of, well, what would this product be? And this is something we've talked about for a while and that you have a great deal of experience with your CTO background. But, you know, it's the concept of a software as a service, cloud-based stack, right, of applications or software services that fit together in a certain way to provide value. And really, if you look at Amazon subsidiary AWS, that's what that is. That is a, you know, by itself a unicorn company, obviously, that, you know, has a vertical stack of applications that fit together. And individually, they're so cheap that it seems almost impossible not to buy them because there's so much value there. And yet, when you think about what has that done for AWS, well, it has made it a huge company in just a few years. Massive company. I have no idea how many billions of dollars they're generating. I don't know if you do, Tom, but it's got to be a huge number.
Right.
And that's something to be thinking about. So when we think about what the product is, because you mentioned a few minutes ago, we don't have a product, but we're going to put together a product, and that's going to, you know, the early heavy lifting in terms of the product is going to fall on you. And then, you know, after that point, in terms of growing this thing, it's going to really fall on me.
And again, you know, to kind of one of these characteristics, the thing about, you know, Amazon, and we'll use Microsoft even in this guy, they tend to create things that they need themselves in order to do business.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So the very first versions of whatever they did,
right,
was because they needed to have them.
Yeah.
And they took part of their head and turned it sideways and says, since we needed this, there's other companies that are likely need the same type of thing. So how do we take this and create a product out of it? And I think that's a fairly, you know, powerful statement. Like, we know this works because we use it every day.
Right.
Right. And this is the way that it transforms our business. And if we do this and this and this, we can then create a product and put it in the market.
Right.
So as we think about, you know, a growth hacking platform or stack, right?
Right.
You know, and I mentioned this, you know, a little bit earlier, CRM seems to be one of the core pieces, right?
It is. It's like the way I think of it with my background in architecture, it's like a foundation. It's like the footing in the ground, if you will, that everything else builds off of, and everything kind of attaches to and relates back to it. And it really is like the footing for the building.
It really is. And yeah. So it's going to show you, you know, who is in your universe of marketing to or selling,
right,
to. It's going to say if they bought or they sold, if they're even interested, right?
Right.
And, you know, as you start to think about stratifying that, right? Hey, we have 1,000, we have 10,000, we have 100,000 contacts. And we'll follow the example of, hey, we know they're all in the technology sector, or they're in the business sector looking for technology, right?
They're in the business sector or providing services to these technology companies, which is
right.
You know, if you think about one of the I'll call it growth hacking successes and near successes we had in our second iteration together. Well, when we went out to Lake Las Vegas and we had an opportunity to pitch to that user conference,
yeah,
you know, we had, I don't know, 200 people in that room at the Ritz-Carlton there in Lake Las Vegas who all had a similar need. Almost everybody in that room had a similar need.
Yeah.
And we were invited in to make that presentation. And, you know, and at the end of that presentation, we had a line of people. You know, I'm going to say it was 100 feet long, 150 feet long, whatever it was, who were ready to sign up.
Yeah.
And talk about a growth hack you know, that is just phenomenal. When you can get a group of people with a common problem that's a pressing problem that need a technology, a particular technology or technology stack in this case perhaps, to achieve their goals, it provides a tremendous opportunity for rapid growth.
Right, but I think even more what you just did is a simple analytical exercise, just using the same kind of case of there was 200 people in the room and we had 100 people lined up.
Yeah.
That's a segmentation, right?
That's
so,
right.
So even in the CRM, it doesn't matter how many you have there, but you have some sort of segmentation or clustering around how your potential customers, what they're looking for, what they look like, what are their needs. So in some cases, that's one of the first steps. So you build a list of 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, you know, you got to test what they're looking for or what they think they need.
Right.
So in there, you know, it's simple enough to lead people to a whole bunch of different areas. Hey, we're going to use this 10,000 list of people, and we're going to send out 3, 5, 10 kind of different emails leading them to different things to better understand what they're looking for. Right.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, that's an interesting segue to a few different things. I mean, one of which is the way that Amazon itself has grown, which is, if you think about it, they have so much data about every one of us that has ever bought from Amazon. It's just incredible, mind-boggling how much data they have. But, you know, when you think about how they collect that data, you know, you make a purchase, you go there to look for one particular book, and then, you know, you get to that page or that URL where that book is, and it says people who bought this also bought this or also like this. And, you know, and they're collecting all that data, and you think about all the analysis they do on that, you know, which has led to these Amazon stores like the one I took you to down in Linfield, where, you know, they know what people in the general geographic area of Linfield are interested in. And so they're able to create a book with a bookstore with a much smaller footprint than a Barnes & Noble bookstore, because they can take the Pareto principle and implement it in a brick and mortar store and say, here's the 20% of products that are going to generate, you know, well over 80% of the sales. So you think about it, a little Amazon bookstore like that can probably do as much sales as a great big Barnes & Noble bookstore that takes the equivalent of a city block.
Because they know the interest of a collective geographic footprint.
They do,
right?
Yeah.
Because they go back and say, within this area, we have 5,000 customers, and of that 5,000 customers, 45% read trade novels, or they read consumer-based novels, right?
Right.
Hey, bestsellers list. We know all these people read bestsellers. We're just going to put in this store mostly bestsellers.
Right.
Because we know they'll do a walk-by, they'll walk in, and they're most likely to buy.
Right.
But let's go back to Amazon for a second in terms of, you know, how they kind of evolved their thinking there, right? So it was easy enough for Amazon to say, okay, this book fits into this category, right? We know that a lot of books, as part of their generic marketing information, contains the book category. Right? It's a categorization system.
Right.
It's called BISAC, right?
Right.
You know, there's 2,000, 5,000, whatever categories. So at first, it was very easy for them to say, hey, if you bought this middle grade, young adult Harry Potter book, right, we know that these 6 other books, which are in the same category, middle grade, young adult, you might be interested in. So in that case, on day one, they were able to kind of create something that took a person to do, right? Hey, we're going to take a look at the books in this category. We're going to know that these are bestsellers, or that these are good or award winnings. They might not be bestsellers. And we're going to create a category list. Okay, now let's call that a person intervention. They knew that this book, through categories, were associated with all these books, but we're going to show these books on their page.
Right.
And then over time, it got smarter, right? It said that, hey, when we show that this book, people don't usually buy all 5 of these books that we recommend. They usually buy 1 or 2. So now we're refining that list, okay? We don't need to show 5, we show 2. And over more time, we can see the back and forth between any of the original 5 back to this book, right?
Right.
That first book. So in that case, that's when the algorithms really start. So as you think about a process of doing this, you don't have to have deep analytics. You just need some way to codify your product and say, hey, you know, people who bought this would be interested in these things.
Right.
But as a consumer, now they're getting, because the longer I stay, the richer and richer history they have on me.
Yeah.
Not only that I buy this type of book, but I buy these six other types of books.
Yeah.
And that opens up the universe. So not only can we track sales, but let's go back to other people like you, which, you know, let's say the middle-aged man who has a 10-year history of reading, you know, sci-fi, computer books, and history books. We'll throw all those in, and how many other people out there like that? So as they learn more and more about their customers, they were learning more and more about how to segment their customers,
yeah,
the relationship to what they wanted, as well as like customers. So in the pool of all the Toms out there, how many of them look like this, and how many of them tend to buy these same types of categories? That's when the real power of automation in this term, in this case, a recommendation engine, right?
Right.
And a recommendation engine is a type of artificial intelligence, and we can talk about that a little bit more. But in this case, you know, that's a bending of our technology curve, right? To say, hey, if one of our, in this product launch, key pieces is about high-tech curves, you know, artificial intelligence is one of them.
Yeah, when you say high-tech curves, what do you mean? Do you mean like growth curves, logarithmic growth curves?
Yeah.
Okay,
so,
sure.
So I forgot what you called it, tech trends.
Yes.
It would be the tech trends.
Right.
So in that case, if implementing artificial intelligence is one of the tech trends, you know, what's the product for that, right? So,
yeah. Or what are the other ancillary required products? I mean, big data comes to mind
correct.
For me, and data analytics obviously comes to mind.
But some of this starts without. And I guess the sequence there is to think about how Amazon created their product, right? So they had small data. They didn't have large data. But they were able to start it because they had enough relationships between their products to understand how to relate them, even though, you know, they might have had zero or no sales, but they would. So an understanding that this is a process to say, hey, we can use people to kind of create these relationships, and then we can see how they perform. Another way to think about it is it's simple A-B testing on a page, right? You're going to create an A page, you're going to create a B page, you're going to figure out what people like more. They might not like either.
Right.
All of them might like just like one.
And you never know until you test them.
That's right. So,
and the things you think that would be highly relevant or, you know, highly impactful may not be impactful at all. And you really never know until you put the choices in front of them.
So, and that's what I really wanted to kind of put a spotlight on. Hey, Amazon didn't have all the answers, and they didn't have all the data, and they didn't have a bunch of smart algorithms. So they were able to do things with people at first.
Yeah.
Just being smart about how to associate or relate things together, that then as their data knowledge picked up, they were able to make smarter and smarter and smarter. They were able to use technology, i.e. the recommendation engine, because they had more and more data. And, you know, in that recommendation engine is really machine learning, which is the more data we're going to get, the more computational statistics we're going to generate, which is going to drive what you're likely to buy on that related products page. All very interesting. But that's not where they started, right?
Right.
That's where they are today,
right.
But that's not where they started.
Yeah. And one of the requirements of getting to the point where they're at today is to have massive quantities of discrete tests, if you will. You know, discrete activities from individuals who have totally different backgrounds, totally different interests, demographics, everything. And, you know, that ability to have so many different tests, if you will, to be able to analyze that data to drive out further actions or strategies or whatever, you know, to achieve greater growth and greater success is really what we're aiming for.
To one of the key characteristics, right? Hey, it's all about growth. And within growth, we have to figure out how two of us or three or four of us can kind of do a 24/7 piece.
Right.
So in this case, it's that automation. Hey, if I have to go and create an A page and a B page for 1,000 products, this is going to take me forever.
Right.
So I couldn't do that manually. I wouldn't want to hire someone to do that manually.
Right.
So you think about, hey, how do we automate this? Hey, we create 5 or 10 different templates. We plug and play different types of products in there. They auto-generate based upon our campaign, right? If you think about this, campaign might not be the right word, but if we're going to start a sell process, right, or an engagement, let's call it an engagement, the engagement plan says, hey, we're going to do a whole bunch of tests on this group to figure out what it is that they really want.
Right.
Right. And how do we automate that? Hey, we've got our list. We can automate generating, sending out emails. How do we automate generating product pages, and how do we how do we automate generating multiple types of pages for the same product?
Yeah, and you know, that's fascinating, you know, hearing that come from you, because obviously you have those abilities. For me to do that stuff is very labor intensive and very slow. You have the ability to create the technology to make that happen, which is phenomenal.
And that goes back to a growth hacking platform.
Right? It does, absolutely.
So how are these things that we'll figure out how to do, how can those be then leveraged by other people, right? So let's not reinvent the wheel. Hey, if there is a smart designer that does really good work, have them create 100 templates, right?
Exactly.
And then as you go to build your engagement with any segmentation of your list, right? You'll want to say, hey, I want to test these two pages, or I want to test these two pages. So you can fit your product information in there, your pitch lines in there, your tripwires in there, but you're not necessarily having to go and create the pages yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And you may recall that I have this fairly complex spreadsheet that I picked up around 2005 about the Japanese, the Taguchi method. Remember that?
The Taguchi method.
Which was really originated back in the World War II era, post-World War II, during the rebuilding of Japan to help accelerate the rebuilding of manufacturing facilities in Japan and to help rebuild the economy. And really the underlying concept of the Taguchi method was to say, you know, what are the activities in the manufacturing process that are most effective and have the highest value, and how can we focus on those activities or those manufacturing processes to produce more at a lower cost in the shortest period of time? Well, that same concept of Taguchi, the Taguchi method, was something that I came across a very smart marketer named James Cowlick back around 2005. He was written up in Forbes magazine, and he took that concept of the Taguchi method and applied it to marketing, and he actually tried developing a piece of software, and I bought into the software, and they never actually delivered it. But I still have that spreadsheet, and that's something that I know I've talked to you about, Tom, in the past, that we want to think about that concept of the Taguchi method. Think about, you know, we're talking about targeting a certain number of verticals. You know, I'm saying roughly 15 verticals to see which of these is going to have some attraction and traction for us in terms of this technology stack that we're going to be developing and promoting. And then within those verticals, also to be looking at the products that we put into this technology stack. And just for purpose of argument, let's say we put 15 products into that, and then we need to apply the Taguchi method or some other form of analytics to say which of those products have the greatest traction. You know, when I look at what products I would want to have, I think of a wish list that I'd like to have, and you know, sometimes I've bought these and sometimes I've, you know, a lot of the products I have are subscription-based products, and you know, I bought some that cost me $300 a month, and you know, you have them for a while, and if you're not using them, you just let them go. And you know, I have other ones I've actually paid $1,000 for some and then never really used it, or it didn't work or whatever, and you know, it's very frustrating. So one of the things we need to do is to make sure that the stuff we have is really going to work, and obviously you have the ability to do that, but making it work is, and you know this from your experience as a CTO of a company that grew to $100 million yourself, but you know, there's a lot of aspects to that. You can make the technology work. That doesn't mean other people can use it.
Yeah.
So it's got to be really easy. And I know that we've talked about this many times in the past, but you know, you think about how Hotmail became what it did, and how, you know, I mean, that was one of the early, you know, ultra fast growth companies I can think of. And it was because it was free and it was a self-promotion platform, really. Every email that went out on Hotmail said this email was sent with Hotmail. You know, and that was a freemium type thing. But you know, eventually they cashed out for a huge amount of money. Skype is another one. I mean, we use Skype frequently. I mean, I've had a love-hate relationship with Skype, but you know, it's a phenomenal platform. And then, you know, and it was free. It is free. And they have I guess I would call it a freemium platform. So they have free to premium. And you know, it's one of those things you look at and go, how can they do this for free? You know, and it's like, this is a lot of value for free. And then look what happens. Microsoft buys them for over $1 billion, right? I don't know how many billion they pay it for, but just amazing. But, you know, what are they really buying? They're buying a user base of, I'm going to say, millions of people that were using Skype. And if you remember, Tom, just a couple of years ago, I was telling you about you mentioned CRMs earlier, and I was telling you about a particular platform, software platform. It was originally for fleet management, meaning vehicle fleet management, but they trying to morph that into service-based company management, including job management and quote management. Mm-hmm. And that company had 35,000 users from what I read, and it was acquired for $4.3 billion, as I require, about 2 years ago. So roughly in 2017, 2016, $4.3 billion.
Yeah.
And I don't know how profitable they were, if they were even profitable. They probably had some money, but I don't know how much money they were making. You know, the real core of their business was their GPS fleet management tracking software. All the other software they had, and you remember because I was grappling with this, you know, it really didn't work that well.
Yeah.
I mean, it looked pretty good, but it didn't work that well. And they're rebuilding it all now, redeveloping it now, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, you think about how do you go from whatever their revenues were to a valuation of over $1 billion.
Right.
And, of course, that concept of that unicorn valuation of over $1 billion is a, you know, that's like a, you know, that is a moonshot. You know, I've referred to this project as Project Moonshot. That's kind of is like a moonshot. You have your Redstone project that you've talked about in the past. But, you know, it really is like, how do you put a man on the moon? I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about.
Right.
How would we get there? And that's really what we're, you know, what we're kicking around here right now is ideas about that. So let's move on this discussion and let's talk a little bit about the technology stack, if you will. And, you know, early on, I mean, you referred to the time when we were working in the publishing industry and how we went and had an opportunity to present to a user group with a couple hundred people in it out at Lake Las Vegas. And they were all using a particular kind of software that solved one of their critical needs, really their distribution and fulfillment needs. But the part that they didn't have was their product management piece of their software. And that's what we were able to bring to the table. And product management is a big, broad topic. It really includes not only creation of the product itself and development of the product and perfection of the product and production of the product and keeping track of all of the marketing metadata or marketing information about the product and the catalog information, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's really everything that attaches to each and every individual product from the time of inception or time of acquisition of that product, if you think about acquisition editors in the publishing world, to the time that the product is actually shipping out of the warehouse. There's a whole lot of information that goes into that. And again, if we touch back on the example of Amazon, you know, part of the information that touches on that in Amazon is who's buying it and what are their demographics.
Yeah.
And that informs them a lot of how many physical books would they send to their Amazon bookstores. And so that idea of, you know, I'm going to call that an early version of a technology stack that we dealt with and worked on. You actually created it. I mean, I remember you spending months actually writing the specifications for that product and then getting it developed and, you know, all the iterations of getting developed. And that's a tremendous amount of work to make that happen. What we're talking about here is, you know, really trying to hack that process, if you will, how to accelerate that process, how to, you know, find shortcuts in it, and how do we get from where we are now, which is zero revenue, to, you know, the first $1 million of revenue in the shortest period of time? Or how do we get to the first $10 million in revenue? And one of the concepts I've talked about with you is, you know, if we, you know, I mean, this is February 1st, 2019. We've been talking about this stuff for a long time. But at this point, we should be ready to go and start, you know, making some traction. And once we have something to sell, how could we get to $1 million in the first year? Or really to try and accelerate that a little bit, it is February 1. How could we get to $1 million by December 31st, 2019? That would be a pretty big achievement, really, to go from zero to $1 million in 11 months at this point. And then the second stage of that, in my mind, is, okay, once we have some traction, and I mentioned the fact that this company we're modeling did have some traction, whether they had $10 million, $20 million in revenues before they started, you know, with this current product set that they have that took them to $100 million in 3 years. You know, once we have $1 million in revenues, is it realistic, and I think it is realistic, for us to get from $1 million to $10 million in year two, if we have some momentum, and if we do it right, and if we learn the right things and put the right processes in place, and if we automate as much as we can, and we need to automate almost everything, really, because we're going to try and do this as a very lean company. We didn't even bring up the concept of a lean company or a lean startup, but I mean, that's really what we're talking about. And you know, what kind of margins are we looking for here, and what is realistic? And, you know, in our past, when we worked in the software field, which was really largely a consulting software field, you know, the margins were, what, maybe 35%, something like that? And I think that's a pretty realistic margin for companies to shoot for, particularly if it's a very labor-intensive or very professional-intensive.
And in the consulting world, that is probably...
In the consulting world, right.
But as you go to the product world, you know, you're kind of on something more than 35%. Something 55, 60, 65.
And that's exactly what I'm thinking.
And then be able to tweak the processes there that drive the incremental gain in that margin. Right?
Exactly.
In the book world, it was, most of the costs were in the first edition, like getting it through creation, right?
Right.
Getting the product through creation, and then it was just run costs after that.
Right.
And in this case, especially with electronic products, you know, the run costs in the future, you know, can be managed, right? So in some world, you know, is the 2019 version better than the 2018 version? Don't know, right?
Right.
You know, or is it such incremental that the small cost from version to version drives new or reoccurring, I'm going to sign up again for 2019,
right?
Because this subscription worked well for me.
Right. You know?
So in there, I think the find more margins easy enough. It lies both in understanding, you know, what your customers want, how they use the current product, as well as automation to kind of iterate those in Windows.
Right, for sure. And, you know, when I think about the concept of using software as a service as the product concept, I guess I'll say, or product matrix or whatever, you know, the costs are really, you know, the startup costs for that product are really in the development of the product itself.
That's right.
And then the rest of it is all in the marketing and sales. And if the marketing and sales, and this gets into the concept of sales funnels, which has been such a huge topic recently over the last few years, and this really goes back, I mean, you go back to the 20 years when we first started together, but, you know, it was really sales pipeline management is what
right.
it was called, you know, in the digital world. You know, funnels, sales funnels, marketing funnels is you know, more commonly used term for that, but getting those funnels so they're functioning properly, so that you have the ability to spend more money on marketing and advertising to drive more traffic into the start of the funnel. You know, that's really where the big challenge comes from. And so I guess this is a pretty good segue point to get into the concept, you know, deeper in terms of modeling and, you know, what to model and how to model these funnels and so on. You know, one of the things that has become known over the past few years, I'm going to say the last 2 or 3 years, is the fact that, yeah, you can create 100 different funnels, sales, marketing or sales funnels, but history has proven, meaning recent history over the past 2 or 3 years, has proven that, you know, the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule, really applies to those funnels too. And, you know, I've read and heard that well over 90% of the revenue comes from three core funnels. And those three core funnels are things that involve, you know, something called a tripwire funnel, which is to say, you know, some people refer to it in the local marketing world, which is companies that provide marketing services to local or regional companies. You know, they call it a foot in the door product.
Yeah.
You know, what is something that is so valuable and so inexpensive and so easy to deliver, something you can deliver with 30 minutes or less time to get your foot in the door, to develop, to show value and show expertise. And, you know, that is kind of a tripwire product. It's almost like a throwaway product, but you need to know that there's a follow-on product to that, which is, you know, I'll call it your core offer. And that core offer is where a lot more of the revenue comes from. And you need to have an expectation that out of the people that you are able to convince to take that foot in the door offer, or that tripwire offer, out of those people, if you sell 100 of those because the offer is so valuable that it's almost impossible for them to turn away from. And a good example of this is in the dental industry, you know, free x-rays or free first exam. I mean, that's one thing you see with Gentle Dental or whatever. You know, your first exam is free or whatever. You know, a lot of chiropractors do the same thing. You know, you come in for a free exam, whatever. And it's really about getting you into a chair where they can then do some analysis and say, oh, geez, you got all these problems. You know, we're going to have to deal with these. And, you know, I'm not saying that they're being dishonest about it. I'm just saying that that's the concept.
Yeah.
And once you're in the chair, and my own sister, this is mind-blowing, but my own sister recently went to a dentist after she had been seeing one dentist for a long time. And she found, and I don't know if it's true, if the analysis is true, but, you know, she was told she needs $56,000 worth of dental work. And I, you know, she doesn't have 56 grand. And, and I don't know if she really needs that kind of dental work, but that gives you a concept of, like, why do people do this? Why does Gentle Dental offer this thing? You know, if you think about it.
Why would anybody tell anybody that, right? So from the business aspect, 56 grand on dental work, you know. why would she start with, like, five?
Well, that is one of the concepts, too, is after the foot in the door, you go to an offer that's you know, what's the next level, which is where you actually recoup your advertising costs and get to at least parity where, you know, what you're spending, but or at least do it in such a way, you know, make it a subscription service, which is really what that Smiles company, there's a teeth straightening thing, something Smiles.
Yeah. And they send you a thing every month, right?
That's basically what they do. It's basically a monthly subscription as opposed to...
Right.
As opposed to spending 10 grand up front, we'll just charge you $90 a month for 5 years or something like that, you know?
Yeah, equal 10 grand.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, it works, and obviously it works, and they're selling, making a lot of sales. But, you know, all of those concepts kind of fit in together, and it kind of ties back to AWS as a model and how AWS makes its money. But, you know, what we've talked about is, you know, there are a million CRMs. You talked about CRMs earlier in this conversation. You know, and there are, like you said, there are a million of those out there. And many of them are free. There are some great free ones out there. And so how do you differentiate yourself in the CRM market? Secondly, how do you make money in the CRM market? Obviously, Salesforce has taken it to the zenith level, if you will.
Yeah.
Salesforce has got to be the most valuable company in the CRM market, you know, followed maybe by Microsoft, or maybe they're in the same stratosphere, I don't know. But, you know, I don't really hear many people talking about Microsoft CRM, which must be part of what, Dynamics or something like that? And, I remember when we were looking at Dynamics and, you know, it's got a lot of really cool stuff. You just don't ever hear anybody talking about it. I don't ever hear anybody talking about it. But Salesforce is everywhere, right? And Salesforce, I've worked with a company for 5-6 months that was implementing Salesforce. They had been implementing it for 2 years. They had to beat people with a stick to get them to use Salesforce.
Yeah.
And, you know, beat people and threaten them. You know, if you don't use it, you're getting fired. And, you know, that isn't a way to hyper growth. I mean, Salesforce has been very successful for a variety of other reasons, not the least of which is that they hired some of the best and brightest people out of Silicon Valley as their executive team. And I remember we met the guy who was the VP of sales out there, and, you know, he came from Oracle. And, you know, if you steal people from Oracle and Microsoft and from Google and Apple, you know, you're probably going to have a pretty good executive team, right? You know, particularly if you're taking them from the highest levels. And I think that's how Salesforce did it. But, you know, again, we're talking about bootstrapping. So how do you make that happen? Well, you need to make products that are so easy for people to use and so valuable, or such time savers, or seem so great and seem so fun, whatever it is, that they're going to tell their friends about it, right?
Yeah.
They want to share it. And that's really one of the keys. And so, I mean...
It is. I would say another characteristic of success with those tools is, you know... how simple is your process, right? So, hey, if you're going to build a funnel, how simple is it? Is it very complex? Because as you drive towards complexity with those tools, it's going to require customization. And even though these are really configurable systems, you know, service-oriented architecture, it takes some level of expertise to make those changes happen. So as you think about, hey, what's our, you know, growth hacking process, and how simple and how complex it is, that's going to drive you what kind of tool you use. And some of those other CRMs, like Zoho, for example, or Zendesk, some of these are really fairly simple things that you can customize fields or workflows fairly easy, which means you don't need expertise.
Right.
And a lot of these have then kind of looked at the integration with other tool sets. So again, back to your process, we know we need to track customers. We know we need to track interactions. We know that we have to generate emails, right? But what else do we have to do? Well, if they sign up, we want payment. And we want that payment to go right back into our core system so we know how much our customers are spending on a monthly, yearly, quarterly basis, whatever the fact is. Well, things like Zapier, which is a tool set that allows you to integrate a bunch of these systems. So I take my Zoho CRM, I plug on my PayPal payment function, and they're integrated, right?
Yeah.
Zapier gives us that ability. And then now Zapier is kind of a marketplace that allows you to pick or integrate certain tools automatically. You don't need the experts to come in and say, hey, we're going to integrate inventory, customer relationship management, payment, and delivery tools. You don't have to worry about it. If you pick a simple platform that has these bolt-ons, you're going to find that they're going to work well together. Again, you're living within a framework of saying, hey, we're a small company, we're flexible enough to do these things versus a big company who has process, who have requirements, departmental level requirements that require more expertise and more integration and more technical know-how.
And more structure and more, decision-making processes and all that kind of stuff. And, and it's really fascinating when you think about it because that's the world we started in together, where you had to get the heads of all the different departments together, which was difficult and time-consuming and just very challenging to get those people to meet in a room together, to have the discussion, and then to get them to agree on what the priorities were was even more difficult and challenging and sometimes impossible.
Yeah.
And then to actually create a project, to get budgeting for a project, is very difficult. And then to actually make the project successful was very difficult. And that's the kind of stuff you dealt with as a technology guy, with the heavy, heavy lifting for a long time.
Yeah.
And when you think about all of the trips that you and I made into Harvard Business School publishing to try and sell them. And we did actually succeed in selling them a system that they really needed, but it took 18 months. And people came and left that company while we were there. The champion of the project left that company to fall in love with some guy in Paris or something. And the guy that was left as the production manager looked at it and said, this is basically a word processor. Well, he was an idiot. It wasn't a word. And this is a guy at Harvard Business School Publishing,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah.
It wasn't a word processor. He just didn't see it. He wasn't smart enough to see it. He didn't care, whatever.
Right.
But that's the, so those are like two extremes. You've got Zapier as one extreme, which is a easy to use plug and play system, self serve. And this is really interesting, Tom, because we haven't talked about this before, but I remember at the very, very beginning of me going to work at QSI with you guys, and I said, well, we need something that an individual could use to make their life easier. And you guys said, no, this is, this is big corporate stuff. Well, you think about Zapier, that's something that an individual can use. And there's a lot of truth to that. I remember the other thing you guys all laughed at me about was like, we need to make this Mac compliant, Apple, and you guys all laughed at me. Ah, no, Nick, you don't get it. Well, I did get it. Okay. So those things were true. But anyway, you look at Zapier and that's fascinating to me. Zapier is a company that I have heard more and more about, really on a monthly basis. It just comes up on my radar more and more every month. And it's because it's so easy to use and because it has so much value. And when I think about this conceptually, Tom, it takes me back to the days when you were doing data cleansing, whatever. And
wrangling.
And you were using data junction for certain things, right?
Conversions,
Data conversions, excuse me, right. And so, that was such a heavy technology lift, if you will. And for a guy like you, it's probably like doing addition and subtraction. But you think about the people that we were serving in those, some of the largest publishing houses in the world, and they couldn't do that stuff. It took a guy like you to be able to do it because you had to use a tool like Data Junction to, first of all, you had to understand the data. And then you had to figure out how to merge these different data fields. And that's where Data Junction came in. And that was really hard to use, even for a guy like you. I mean, maybe not that hard for you, but it was really hard to use. And now you look at Zapier, which is just this semantic layer, is a term we used to use. It's a semantic layer that makes it really easy for people like me, who's really a marketing guy, to say, okay, I want to get this information from here to here. How can I make that connection? And I haven't got my hands on Zapier yet, and I need to, but I have the impression that that's what it does, right?
Well, so, and I'll use Slack because
Slack is a great
Slack
idea.
Slack is another tool here. So Slack is a team collaboration tool.
Yeah.
And in there, you can think, well, you know, technically, there's tons and tons of team collaboration tools. You know, there's
like CRM. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, in the world of, hey, I put my designs or my requirements or whatever into Microsoft Word or Google Doc, right? So, but, you know, I don't want to have to retype that stuff within Slack. You know, I want to be able to consume that information around documents right into my Slack channels.
Right.
So Slack invests in that kind of connectivity to say, hey, you want to bring in your Google Calendar, this is how you do it, you want to bring in this, you want to bring in Trello, which is a, you know, kind of an agile project management / design / collaboration tool. You can do this and use Slack as your kind of front end for all these back end systems. In a way, it was Slack's brilliance to say, hey, let's integrate with tools around this type of these types of environments or needs, and use our tool as a way to tie them together in an asynchronous kind of way that allows us to kind of find and follow what's going on with a bunch of different tool sets. Now,
yeah.
Zapier is one of those kind of tools that say, hey, let's kind of put all these pieces under the framework. But that's the way that, you know, and they're pure growth hacking, right? Hey, if you use our tool or that tool, this is brought in this way, everything has an email trailer on it. But ultimately, it's that place which we are, which, you know, in the days 20 years ago when we had Data Junction to do data conversions, we kind of saw the EDI, Mercator-like tool sets to be so complex in order to connect two systems.
And you found those to be so complex.
That's
you
right.
are a heavy-duty technology guy, and you found them that complex,
right.
Which is really something.
That's right. And then now move to the world, hey, that was 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Now move to the world, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, where we start to see, you know, these SaaS-based platforms.
Right, software as a service, yep.
That are made out of the gate to integrate with tools for needs, right? So if it's Word, if it's Excel, if it's Google Docs, if it's spreadsheets, whatever it happens to be, they automatically plug and play with those out of the gate. Why? Because they know the majority of people will type in Word or a Google Doc, their requirements, or in an email, they'll put these things in, and then we're using Slack as a way to follow a thread of these things in an asynchronous communication pathway, right?
Right.
Yeah, I know you did this last week. Where do I find it? Do I go looking at email? Do I go looking at a network drive? Hey, we live in a world where we no longer have connected networks. I need it in Slack so I can find it on a moment's notice.
Right, right. And actually, that's interesting that you, I mean, bringing up software as a service. Is software as a service as a product type as opposed to software, conventional software? I mean, we started out in the client server mode, which is very, very tedious as a way to get adoption because it involves so many different decision makers and products and in budget requirements and so on. Whereas software as a service, it's just there. I mean, people just need a user account basically to access the software. And then it's already hosted, it's already there, they just need to be able to access it. And of course, internet connectivity makes all that stuff viable and feasible and so on. All right, I'd like to focus more on revenues and how we're gonna try and get to where we're going. And I wanna bring up one of the key metrics that I picked out. And again, one of the underlying concepts that drives the viability of this moonshot is the fact that we have companies that we can model and certain metrics that we can model. I mentioned one of them, which was from that software company in the GPS fleet tracking business, where they had 35,000 users and they had a valuation of over $4 billion, a sale purchase of over $4.3 billion, as I recall. You know, those are key metrics. And in terms of this software as a service growth hacking company that we're kicking off here, you know, one of the key metrics I have is that this model company had over 50,000 customers, paying customers, after, you know, I'm going to say 2 years, 3 years, whatever, And that's part of what drove the revenues that they have. And I want to go back because I remember watching this company emerge or watching this startup emerge. It was really a spin-off of an existing company. I've mentioned that they already had some momentum. And I know that even though they had momentum, I knew they were at $20 million at one point. And I think they had some operational problems that caused them to have to scale back and really close a division that they have. Maybe they went back to $10 million, maybe they went to $5 million, I don't really know. But they still had some inertia, they still had some momentum. And the thing is, they created this new product, and the early versions of this product were pretty unimpressive, I'll say. They, you know, even the graphics were really like crayon kind of graphics as opposed to, some fine art or whatever. And I found the graphics kind of crude, personally. And when I say crude, I just mean just not sophisticated. And yet they sold a lot of it. And the history is filled, modern history, business history, is filled with companies, Apple versus Microsoft. Most people think that Apple's products are actually superior to Microsoft products, but Apple did a better job selling it in so many different ways. And you think about how Apple packages their products, and something like the iPod or whatever, packaging of that is like a little jewel box, and the way that they do that is really impressive. And so when we think about what we're doing here, it's important to note that we may make a product stack that is actually, well, first of all, we're not trying to replicate what this other company has done. We're trying to do something quite different, really. But we're trying to do it in a way that, picks up on some of the successes and learns from some of the successes that they had and how did they achieve what they did. Their product stack, if you will, is really, I think, like two or three different products together. And I never hear anybody talking about two of those products. It's really one product that you hear people talking, or I hear people talking about. And within that product, they have a whole bunch of different flavors, if you will, or different channels, if you will, or whatever. And yet, out of all those different flavors, there's really a handful, less than 10, that people really use or even identify with or even know of. And, so it's important, again, that brings up the concept of the Pareto Principle or the 80-20 rule or whatever. Where's the revenue come from? Where's the $100 million? And they're certainly headed for $1 billion themselves, and my guess is they'll be there within 3 to 5 years. But we need to think about what we're going to do and so on. And so our product set, and I think this will be a good segue into our next conversation, is what should that product stack be and how we're going to think about putting that together. And so that would be a good conversation for us to have next, for the next topic. But thinking about the revenues and what are the metrics. And so I mentioned a few minutes ago that getting to 1 million by the end of this calendar year would be a great goal to shoot for. I think it would be a great goal to shoot for. And I certainly would love it if we can exceed that, but that would be a measure of success. And then to get from 1 million to 10 million is a huge lift, but it is a potentially viable lift and certainly is achievable. And then if you're at 10 million and you've actually experienced this with your company, of course they brought in investors who basically tore apart your company, as far as I can tell, and destroyed it, I think. But but they made it to 100 million, I'm going to say. But and we don't want to do that. But we just want to get to that next level. And if we're focused on being a lean company, if we're focused on growing our margins, and we're focused on controlling our costs, if we can operate at a 50% margin ourselves or 55%, if we get to 10 million. And it's just the two of us and no other employees and just some outsourcers somewhere, and if we're figuring out how to employ the so-called four-hour rule or whatever, four-hour work week, that would be a phenomenal success right there, because we'll have some revenues to split, some earnings to split ourselves, which would be great, which is the whole point. And having fun along the way, obviously.
Yeah.
But, thinking about how we're going to get to 1 million and 10 million and so on. I've mentioned to you before, and I think this is a good thing to include in this inaugural conversation here, the concept of $1 million launch. And I know and there are many, many examples of $1 million launches that I personally have witnessed over the past, really over the time that our two paths diverged while you went to work in the healthcare industry, and I went to work, doing some things in online marketing and some SEO consulting and some lead generation stuff and so on, and the stuff I've done recently with the guy I've been working with, just experiencing, some of that stuff. But, really thinking about what does it take to get to $1 million launch and how does that happen? And it does take a process for sure. When I think about, I mean, really, that's what this company did to start off with. When this company started, the same product that they sell for a minimum of $97 a month now was being sold for $27, not on a monthly basis, but I think it was a, you know, one-time purchase, $27. That's probably how they get their first 100, 500,000 customers. And they gave away at least half of that money to, more than half that money, to affiliates who promoted their product. And they had giveaways, which is part of how those million-dollar launches happen. They had these giveaways that we can think about and model, or think about how to model those things, where they gave away something with huge perceived value of $50,000, $100,000, literally, as a reward for any of their affiliates who brought them 100 customers. And really, the way that they structured that giveaway was very, very clever, because they weren't really buying the product and giving it to them. They were agreeing to pay the lease costs for that product for 3 years or something like that. And the way that they paid that, this was not easily visible to anybody, but if you really look at it as I have, you realize that what they were really doing is saying, we'll take some of the revenues you're generating for our software and as a service sales, and we'll pay those to pay for the lease on the vehicle that you want. If you want a Mercedes, you can have a Mercedes. You want a Porsche, you can have whatever your dream car is, you can get it, and we'll buy your, that was we'll buy your dream car. They weren't really buying it. They were paying the lease for it. Yeah. And they were paying the lease for it as long as the revenues were coming in to pay the lease for it.
Yeah.
If those revenues stopped, I'm quite sure that whole thing stopped and you had to turn in the keys, whatever. But it was a tremendously persuasive and successful, and, you know, I'll use the term, haven't used it yet today, but, you know, had a lot of sex appeal. It got a lot of eyeballs onto this whole process. Got a lot of people involved, got people excited. And the people that were involved and excited, it's worth noting, all became users of the product.
Yeah.
At like virtually, I'm going to say every one of them became users of the product. And that's interesting to think about, because the product itself supported their efforts to achieve their goal of winning one of these cars, the free dream car that they wanted.
Yeah.
And it supported their goal of reaching their goal of financial independence, so they never had to work for a sucky boss again, which we've all experienced before. Or I should just say a frustrating boss. You know, I remember, you know, somebody we both know, great guy, really love him, but, you know, he was like a black hole for marketing as far as I'm concerned. You know, I remember him saying, Nick, that nothing kills a great marketing faster than a bad product. And like, glad you have so much enthusiasm and and confidence in the product, you know. So, but anyway, we all want to, I think it's part of human nature. It's certainly part of our experience as Americans to want to be financially independent, to want to be self-employed, to want to not have to check in. I know, Tom, during your recent 7-year period or 6-year period, whatever it was, you know, when you had that, you know, very impressive and lofty role as the CTO of that company, you know, with a very hefty paycheck and bonuses and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, you were getting up at, 5 in the morning to slog into Boston and getting home at 8:30 at night or something. And you did that for like 7 years, I think. You know, that takes a toll.
It does.
Yeah. And you had stuff to do on weekends and calls to make. And, you know, you had hundreds of people to support. And that's a lot of weight to carry on your shoulders.
Yeah.
So you need a little time off. And, you know, your wife ought to cut you some slack and not tell you you need another job. You know, you got the money. Just kick back and relax. But anyway, that's all. You know, that's all part of what fits into how they made that launch and so on. So you and I, Tom, we're going to have to think about how we tap into what the, you know, if you think about, you know, I mentioned the VP of sales for Epiphany, if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
That's the guy that had come from Oracle. Yeah, we can wrap this up in a few minutes. That's the guy that had come from Oracle, and you know, he used to talk about the quadrants. You need the Z, the Z factor.
Yeah.
So when we talk about what we're building here and the fact that we're going to be selling this into, you know, it really is a B2B sales process that we're going through, and it is going to involve potentially other departments and so on. How can we make this a product? How can we make this a product stack that will not involve all these other departments? And that really gets into the concept that we've talked about, really, which is let's make it a growth hacking product stack. In which case, it's really going to be a VP of marketing or VP of sales that's going to be making the decision on this.
Well, yeah, you wipe away all the complexity. It doesn't require an IT department. It doesn't
exactly.
require developers. It doesn't require someone who knows and understands analytics. You start to wipe away some of those things, either through automation or as a software as a service function.
Right.
So all these things kind of exist, whether they're hardwired in the product or they're done in the background, doesn't really matter.
Right. Exactly.
So you make it that experience for, hey, if a one person company can use this,
yeah,
right, a 1,000 person company could use it and it would save them, right?
Right.
So the smarter that product is, the more capable of automating processes, it leads you to say, I don't need three guys in my marketing department, one to do the analytics, one to do the import, exports, grunt work, one to do this. You know, you're looking at a one-person job, and maybe it's not the VP, maybe they hand it off, which allows the VP to focus on more different things.
Yep.
So I think that's what the automation, that's what the integration, the automatic integration, and the simplicity bring to the overall offering, right?
Yep.
Is to say that it doesn't require a PhD in whatever to make this work.
Right.
It's not multidisciplinary. I can sit down and figure out how to make it work pretty quickly.
Yeah, and if the sales pricing, if the price point, and this leads us back to Amazon, I'm not right. saying this is the number, but you know, if you remember back to the time that Amazon was just launching, you know, we all, you know, it was, the word was put out at Book Expo America to every publisher.
Yeah.
$20 is the magic number.
Yeah.
Below $20, products move much, much faster than anything above $20.
Yeah.
And that I remember that concept spread like wildfire, literally, at Book Expo. I mean, everybody knew $20 is the magic number.
Yeah.
You know, you need to price your products below that if you want them to move really fast. And so, you know, how many times have I been in Barnes & Noble, for instance, or on Amazon.com, and, you know, you buy a book, you go there for one book, and then before you know it, you spent $100 because you bought five books. That's the concept.
Yeah.
And so when I think about the stack that AWS has, you know, each individual product is so cheap, you got to have it.
Yeah.
And that's really the concept. How do you look at some guy? I got to have that.
Yeah.
You know, I got to have it. Oh, that's only $6 a month. I got to have it.
Yeah.
You know, and if all those things together come up to, you know, ideally up to like $100 a month for a company,
yep.
You know, how many VP level people can spend $100 a month? Everyone, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That should be a no-brainer. It should not require any approval from anybody else. I'm spending $100 a month. Give me a break.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in charge of this department. Of course, I'm going to spend that. And, you know, $100 a month is the starting point. You know, that could be for one level. And then, if for a whole quantum leap ahead of value, it's going to cost you $300 a month.
Yep.
And it's very difficult to not spend that $300 because there's so much more value there. Of course, you want all those other things.
Yep.
But that's really the concept for the product stack that we need to try and hammer out.
Yep.
And the reason I'm using those numbers is because those are the numbers that the model company we're looking at is using. They started at $27, and I'm not sure if that was a one-time purchase price. I think it probably was, but I may be wrong. And because, you know, it is difficult. It's a difficult lift. It's a difficult sale to get people to buy into a subscription. We all have subscription charges that we would prefer not to see every month on our bill. But if the value is high enough, we'll do it. And I have a number of things that I'm subscribed to right now. I do need to go back and look at them. Go, yeah, I haven't really used that. I need to cut it off.
Yeah.
It's only $20 a month, but I've got to cut it off. And, you know, even Microsoft, you look at Office 365, $10 a month. It's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
It is a no-brainer. I like to
have it.
You
use it every day.
Yeah. It's a no-brainer. And so that's part of that stack that we're talking about is if it's something you're going to use every day and it's only $10 a month or only $20 a month, that's amazing.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the case of that Microsoft thing, everybody needs one.
Right.
It's not just one person at a company. Everybody needs one. Yeah. So, alrighty, this has been a good conversation. I think we've covered a lot of ground. I think we have a pretty good idea of where we want to go next with the next conversation. I'd love to have the next conversation fairly soon. It took a while to get this set up, but this will be good. We're at about an hour and 8 minutes on this thing. And so I'm going to stop this.